Welcome to Holy Unhappiness, conversations about the expectations we have of what the life of faith will feel like. I'm your host, Amanda Held Opelt, author of the book Holy Unhappiness, God, Goodness, and the Myth of the Blessed Life. Each week, I'll be speaking with writers, pastors, artists, and friends about the myths we believe about the good life. Together, we'll reimagine what blessing can look like if we are willing to look beyond our culture's definition of happiness and success. Welcome. I'm glad you're here.
As this podcast airs, I have just passed the 5-year anniversary of what was probably my most profound loss, the death of my only sibling, my sister Rachel. Now, I have always been a person who struggled with anxiety, but let me tell you, grieving a loss as sudden and catastrophic as that has given entirely new shades and dimensions to my mental health struggles. Grief is brutal. It is a whole person experience, body, mind, heart, everything. And learning to integrate it into your life requires you to develop a whole new set of skills that they don't teach in school, apparently, skills you never wanted to develop in the first place. Loss is central to the conversation about mental health and well-being. And that's why I wanted to bring on a psychologist who specializes in the experience of grief and who, frankly, I think has such a soothing voice, you are just going to want to listen to this recording on repeat. Dr. Mikael Harris has her PhD in clinical school psychology from the University of Houston. Dr. Harris has served in higher education along with community and hospital-based mental health programs. She currently works in private practice as a licensed psychologist and CEO of Harris Psychological Services, offering mental health support across the lifespan. Dr. Harris also provides training, education, and consultation to organizations across the globe focused on an array of mental health themes. She's co-founder of Bloomwell Partners, a consulting firm that equips corporate entities with the skills necessary to afford grief-informed leadership and care within the workplace. I think that is absolutely amazing. In June of 2016, she authored the memoir, Relaxing into the Pain, My Journey into Grief and Beyond. Dr. Harris has created coursework and toolkits for coping with loss and understanding the intersection of grief and the body. She's written articles for lots of magazines and online publications and has appeared as a mental health expert on television and radio programs. She really is an incredible resource on this topic, and I think you are really going to love our conversation. So what I would love is for some of our listeners who may not be familiar with your work, I would love for you to tell us a little bit about how you came to work in the study of grief. Most people, I think, don't just choose to become, you know, grief writers or grief experts. It's something that they have transformative experience with grief, and it leads them to this very special calling. So could you just tell us a little bit about your story and what led you to this work?
Absolutely. So you are absolutely correct that grief found me. I was not looking for it. So I became a licensed psychologist about 15 years ago, and ironically started my career in the 90s working with children and families with developmental differences. And so what I didn't realize at the time was that those were all exposures to loss. That was sort of preparing my heart and preparing me for the work that I was inevitably going to do. But what ultimately led my decision to transform my career in a new way was the death of my mom. Mm-hmm. So in the fall of 2012, my mom, who was a registered nurse, a nursing professor, and just a beautiful, beautiful spirit, started to experience some random symptoms. Mm-hmm. And my mom was a huge talker. And so when I called her in the fall and she said, you know, I just don't feel like talking on the phone. I knew that something was wrong, but I didn't know what it was. So what inevitably ended up happening was that in December 2012, she passed away from stage 4 pancreatic cancer, which was only 30 days after her diagnosis. And in the moment, obviously, that was extremely devastating. And what I ultimately found after she died was that there weren't a lot of spaces mm-hmm. to really readily talk about grief. Mm-hmm. And so in the years after she died, I decided to become the thing that I wish I'd had after her death. And so hence my career and specialty in grief and loss.
Right. Which was absolutely yeah. my experience as well, was this feeling of like, mm-hmm. I have no idea what I'm doing. I feel like there aren't as many resources as I would like for there to be out there. And many mm-hmm. of the resources that are out there are very prescriptive. You know, the, mm-hmm. a lot of, especially in Christian spaces, some spiritual bypassing that happens when it comes to grief. And mm-hmm. and so, you know, it's like they often say authors write the book that they wish they had themselves, the book that they need. I think you and I both did that. Right. So I want you to talk a little bit about mm-hmm. your book. You have this phenomenal title, and just the concept alone, I often use and reference you and say, like, this, you know, there's Dr. Mikhail Harris, she talks about this concept of relaxing into the pain. Tell us a little bit about what yeah. inspired that title and why that concept meant so much to you.
Yeah. So when my mom died, I spent the next probably almost 2 years actively avoiding grief. I was a psychologist at the time, so this may sound ironic, but I did not want to go to therapy. I did not want to be part of the grief club.
Yeah.
And so I was determined that I was going to continue to work and thrive in my career and focus on other things. And if I ran fast and hard enough, that grief wouldn't catch me. Well, we already know how that story yeah. ended. About a year and a half after her death, I was taking a flight from LA to Washington, D.C. And I was charged with working on this grant committee. Mm-hmm. And on the flight, there were just so many experiences that I was having. Number one, I was emotionally falling apart, mm-hmm. even though there wasn't anything on the plane that was actively happening. My body started to sort of experience things that I hadn't experienced, and I knew something was wrong. So by the time I made it to the hotel room, I found myself literally on the floor of my hotel room, crying out to God, mm-hmm. calling every friend that I could think yeah. of to sort of soothe the pain that I was feeling, and nobody answered the phone. I didn't realize at the time that that was more of a spiritual valley mm-hmm. that God allowed me to be in yeah. to see him, which I can talk about in a second. But after I got back home, I said, you know what? The way that I've been trying to do this for a year and a half is not working. Yeah. And so I made the decision to go to therapy. And so I grudgingly walked through the door, grudgingly met week after week. And I remember my therapist saying, you know, Mikhail, one of the things that I know about you is that you are high achieving, mm-hmm. you are stubborn, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. and that's allowed you, right, to sort of continue this path mm-hmm. without actively diving into grief. However, what would it look like if you relaxed into mm-hmm. the pain? And that is where the title of my book came from. And I realized that it was so important for me to stop avoiding it and with curiosity, lean into the emotional, the physical, the spiritual questions that were coming up. And that led me a couple years later to write a book, Relaxing Into the Pain, My Journey Into Grief and Beyond.
Yeah. You know, I feel like we could almost do like a whole podcast on like high achievers experiencing grief or Enneagram 3s experiencing grief. That is me, or like, yes. Or even in yes. even high achievers experiencing mental illness, because there is this mm-hmm. sense that like, it's almost a competition. Like I should be able to beat this. I should be able to outsmart this.
Yes.
I will do all the right yep. things, you know, mm-hmm. and think the right way and do all my self-care and I will be fine. Like this mm-hmm. won't impact me yep. like other people. There's this personal elitism, and I don't know if it's pride or if it's seeing other people in a way that's not respectful. I don't know what it is. It's just this idea that I am too good for this. I am above this. Yeah. I'm above falling apart, and I am above this mm-hmm. mental health challenge that I'm struggling with. And so mm-hmm. it's this constant, you know, you're always kind of hyper vigilant and tensed. And got kind of your emotional dukes up all the time, which mm-hmm. is why I think mm-hmm. that phrase relaxing into the pain really meant a lot to me too. Cause it was like, you're gonna need to just almost like if grief is a river, you gotta start floating down this river because you cannot yeah. swim upstream. Like you cannot swim against mm-hmm. the current of this. You are wearing yourself out. You're exhausting yourself.
Yeah. What was so interesting was at the time I was working at a children's hospital mm-hmm. and I was often charged with working with these kids who were going into these really painful medical mm-hmm. procedures. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as they were exposed to needles or whatever it is that they were concerned about, I would sit with them and I would literally say, okay, one of the things that will help as you sort of recognize that the needle is coming towards you is to relax, mm-hmm. is to breathe into yeah. it. And I remembered when my therapist that said this going, oh yeah, if I tense up throughout this grieving mm-hmm. process, that's only going to make things yeah. worse, yeah. right? However, if I decide to breathe with mm-hmm. it, to relax into it, not that it won't be painful, mm-hmm. but it won't be as painful as it would have been yeah. With active avoidance.
Yeah.
And so I always keep that visual in mind, even now, yeah. when I notice my natural tendency, which is to do overdue, high achieve, mm-hmm. avoid, all those yeah. things. But yet I'm pulled back to the reality that we've got to surrender,
yeah.
Which has, as difficult as it is, has definitely blessed my journey
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
And allowed me to do the work that I'm
doing. Yeah. Yeah. Cause you can't really start the work until you admit the work needs to be done for yourself, you know? And
that's right.
You know, I think right. part of the reason I brought you on here is again, you're a licensed psychologist and you've experienced grief. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear you, you know, maybe you could put your academic hat on a bit if you want to, but I'd love to hear you describe the impact that grief can have on a person's, both their physical health, but also their long-term mm-hmm. mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to sort of lay the foundation for people who may not know what grief is, right? So grief is simply a natural and a normal response to a loss, whatever that loss is, loss of something and or the loss of someone. And the reason I emphasize natural and normal is because in the society we mm-hmm. live in, sometimes it feels like what we're going through is abnormal, yeah. but the reality is that we all face yes. loss. It's a universal theme. And if you haven't experienced it yet, you will. So with grief can come a whole host of reactions. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I often like to dispel is that grief is not just emotional, mm-hmm. right? So we often think of the person who is laying in the corner as I was, crying, yeah. unable to move, unable to process things emotionally, just very visibly mm-hmm. upset. However, grief is invisible. And so often we're interacting with people who are smiling, who are going to work, who are functioning and doing things with their families mm-hmm. and on their job. And internally, they're really suffering. Yeah. So one of the things that we have to be careful of is that we really go beneath the surface to understand what's happening internally. So grief is an internal response to loss. Mm-hmm. Mourning is the external expression of loss. And it's sometimes those don't always match. And so it's important to sort of look at that. To your question, some of the ways that grief can manifest is emotional. Mm-hmm. So of course, crying is one typical way, but not always. Heightened irritability, mm-hmm. right? Just emotional, what I call emotional discombobulation, mm-hmm. right? An array of emotions that come all at once. Yeah. that you have a hard time really sorting through. Yeah. Anger, sadness, overwhelm, irritability, all those things. And that's just to name a few, are some of the emotional expressions. Physically, and this is where mine really manifested, was random aches and pains. Mm-hmm. So we often think about, you know, as I mentioned, grief being internal. Mm-hmm. Well, if grief is internal and we're not outwardly expressing mm-hmm. that, you can almost think of grief as having no place to go. Mm-hmm. And so what it does is that it stores in the body and it can manifest in that way. Yeah. So some of the things that can happen are random aches and pains, a really common phenomenon, sleep dysregulation, headaches, fatigue, feeling as if you're walking around with bricks is the way that some of my clients have described it, just a heaviness on your person that makes it really difficult to function. Right. And spiritually, there are manifestations and so forth, but I'll stop there so that we can talk a little bit about those two areas.
Yeah. And I think what's so important to remember is that grief looks different on everyone. Like I sometimes like to say, hey, just because I'm not crying, does it mean I'm not grieving? Does it mean I'm not, not feeling it today? I think it, sometimes we kind of have in our mind like kind of what a stereotypical griever might look like and how they might be expressing themselves. And for some people it's numbness and for some people it's rage and for some people it's deep fear and anxiety and for some people it's all bound up in their bodies. And that is the way that grief finds a way to come out and finds a way to express itself. And I it was really helpful. We had Andy Kolber on the podcast a couple weeks ago, and it was really helpful for me to hear her say, don't judge other people's expression of grief, but don't judge your own either, because your body is what it needs to do to survive. And so if you find that you've become, I sometimes call it grief constipation. Sorry if that's a little crass, but it's like, if you find I know it's there, I'm having trouble expressing it, I'm having trouble processing it, don't judge yourself or rush the process, because your body might be doing what it needs to survive in this moment. Be patient. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I want to elaborate on that, because one of the things that I share with my clients is no one wakes up on any given day and thinks, this is the day that I'm going to get the phone call that's going to change the rest of my life. So from a physical perspective, our nervous systems are designed to be in what we call homeostasis, which is balance. Yeah. And in a perfect world, when stress happens, our body responds to that. So there's sort of a crescendo and then there's a resolution, which gets us back to that state of homeostasis. Yeah. With grief, however, because it's so long-term, our body can sort of remain in a heightened state. Mm-hmm. And so in the beginning, and again, we're not thinking of this in stages, but in the acute timing of a loss, your body is in a heightened state of overwhelm. Yeah. And so that can make it difficult to experience rest in any way. Mm-hmm. And over time, as grief ebbs and flows, just when you think, okay, we're getting to a resolve. Yeah. Oh no, there's something that happens that sparks a memory and you're right back there. And so it takes a while for our bodies to sort of regulate itself. And in the meantime, it's surviving. Yeah. And so that can look like weight gain because your body is thinking, I need to put this on so this person can survive in the long run. Or this person is not sleeping, which is frustrating. Yeah. But the body is thinking, okay, this person needs to be alert and aware of things that may be happening around them. So it's sort of a way to reframe some of these really frustrating physical manifestations that drive us crazy as we're grieving. Yeah.
Well, and I didn't send this question to you in advance. I don't want to spring it on you. But do you have any thoughts on like the five stages of grief? It's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, I think, the five stages of grief. What are your feelings about it? Share what you're willing to share.
So as you mentioned, Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was a Swiss psychiatrist who, in her work with those who were actively dying, terminally ill patients, she over time began to notice that in the very beginning of diagnosis, people were shocked right? And they were in the state of what she framed as a denial. Mm-hmm. And what she noticed that as they got closer and closer to the day that they died, they had reached a place of resolution or acceptance. Mm-hmm. And so she coined this the five stages of grief. Now, this was intended for the dying yes. patient. However, because she was really revolutionary in talking about loss, her stage theory sort of got translated mm-hmm. for those who survive grief, grief survivors. And that's where we came up with the five stages of grief. So there was an assumption that as we grieve, we start off in denial, we start bargaining, we get angry, we get sad, and then all of a sudden we reach this place of acceptance. Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, even in 2024, we hear about the stages of mm-hmm. grief. As a matter of fact, a famous singer coined an entire playlist focused on these stages. And again, I think that what the stages of grief can offer are potential responses yeah. to loss.
Yes.
But grief is definitely not linear in any way. And acceptance really is relative. And so we really have to be yeah. careful when we're talking yeah. to grievers, because a lot of shame can be placed on a griever for not doing it the right yes. way, if you
will. Right. And yeah. making you think that there's this linear progression, as if like, if I can just tick mm-hmm. tick this off the list, that I'm moving forward and I'm going to graduate from grief someday. And yeah, you know, once I realized there was no graduating from grief, I spent, you know, a few months like really cursing this poor Swiss woman's name. You know, it's like, how dare you? How dare you put this framework on me and give me all these expectations? At the same time, maybe the gift that she did give was some kind of language to talk about what grief mm-hmm. feels like. Because grief is just this, it is ubiquitous, it is universal, and yet it feels so mysterious and so hard to get your fingers around. It's so hard to describe. It's the mystery of death and our interaction with it. In some ways, it's like, okay, well, she did give us some vocabulary that may have served us, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think what's happened is, if you look at the contemporary grief research, mm-hmm. A more meaningful way to sort of think about this are, for example, Warden's tasks of mourning, mm-hmm. which again is not linear. It's saying, here are some tasks that as you grieve, you confront, yeah. such as making meaning out of the mm-hmm. loss mm-hmm. and being able to integrate this loss into your daily life. Yeah. So those are all activities or tasks, if mm-hmm. you will, that we, as we grieve, really do come to realize, yeah. Which is a much more helpful framework than saying, start at A and Z,
right. Right? Exactly. Yeah. Well, so yeah, speaking of contemporary grief studies, I am curious, you know, that you probably heard that quote unquote prolonged grief disorder has been recently yep. added to the DSM-5. And the DSM-5, mm-hmm. for those who don't know, is a diagnostic, what does the S stand for? Manual.
Statistical manual, 5th edition.
Yes, it's kind of yes. for the psychologists and psychiatrists, mental health world. It's kind of a way of describing mental mm-hmm. health illnesses in the mental health world, the mental health experience. Right. I'm curious what your feelings on this idea of prolonged grief being kind of, in some ways, kind of tacitly pathologized by adding it to the DSM. What's your thinking on that?
Yeah, so I will answer this sort of in a circular way by starting with the idea that the DSM-5 and other sorts of nomenclature around mm-hmm. diagnosis are anchored in the biomedical model. So our society, you know, we understand medical disease, and it is important as a medical doctor to be able to look at a constellation of symptoms and say, okay, this person is beating this, this, and this. This falls within this diagnostic category. However, what's happened in the psychiatric world is that we've sort of transposed that biomedical model on invisible psychiatric illnesses, and it's not as clean. It's not as cut and dried. Right. So I will say with the DSM-5 as a whole, it's really difficult to sort of categorize. At the same time, it is important that we have a framework for understanding diagnosis, because that can lead to appropriate treatment and intervention.
Right, right.
Okay, so I don't want what I'm about to say to sound as if we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Right.
And I will interject in this moment too to say that sometimes with our medical insurance being the way that it is in this country, I just came back from Europe where they all get free healthcare and I've got a lot of thoughts on it. But you know, sometimes if you can kind of receive a diagnosis, what that means, that is kind of rooted in that more biomedical world, it will kind of trigger insurance to cover your treatment. And so if that's the case, if like someone can't afford grief therapy because, you know, they haven't gotten an official diagnosis, then this could potentially lead to accessing resources that you need through your insurance. So I'll throw that out there as a plus, I guess, but continue. But you're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater,
Right. Yeah. So I think there's always a space for diagnostic categorization. At the same time, it can be problematic. Yeah. So prolonged grief disorder, again, just to anchor the definition, is broadly defined as an individual, a person diagnosed with this would be an individual who is experiencing intense and sort of prolonged yearning for the loss of a loved one or whatever they perceive as a loss in adults for more than 1 year. And for adolescents and children for more than 6 months. Okay, so the question then is, what is intense and what is prolonged? What is yearning? Yeah. My mom died in 2012, and 11 years later, I still yearn for her presence. Yeah. I still yearn for her voice and memories and things that we have shared and activities. Yeah. And at times it is very intense, right? So I was talking with a friend the other day and I was telling her that I was driving through my city and came to an intersection that happened to be the street that I was on and Patricia Lane. Well, my mom's name was Patricia and I found myself just wrecked. Like I felt the very first day when I learned of her diagnosis. Yeah. And it was extremely intense. I had to shut down the rest of my day. I had to rearrange everything because I was so emotionally overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So the DSM and other diagnostic frameworks are subjective. And that's a problem. Yeah. That's a problem because what's intense for one person may not be as intense. What's significant yearning for one person may not be what's significant for someone else.
Yeah, right.
So there's some problems here. At the same time, one of the things as a diagnostician that I sort of think about is functional impairment, which basically means to what extent is this grieving impairing or affecting the person's ability to show up at work, to get up out of bed and take care of day-to-day activities. And again, there's some subjectivity with that. However, if we can sort of frame it up in that way, it provides a lot better information, right? There are days where I don't want to get out of bed. There are days and moments and maybe a few days in a row where it's difficult to function because your mind is taking you back to that initial awareness. Right. At the same time, for the most part, you're able to show up for your world. You're able to function and you're able to integrate this loss into the daily world. Yeah. So prolonged grief disorder is problematic. And there can be value in it for those who are extremely functionally impaired years, months after significant loss.
Well, and you know, this is something actually I've been talking with my therapist about quite a bit, especially not just about grief, but as we've been kind of wrestling with and working through this kind of anxiety that I have had since childhood. And I'm not going to get into the details of it, but it's this idea of like, I finally said to her last week, I need you to tell me when I have crossed a line into mental illness, because to me, it was like, I kind of needed some sense of permission. Like you've crossed this red line that makes you eligible for medical medication as intervention. And so that I can now say, this is what I have. I have this.
This is
where I am. And I have this. This has a term. This has language. And that is who I am and what I am. And now I have kind of these categories that are going to make me, that are going to feel like a tool to equip me. And what she said to me is she was like, I really wish there was a very clear line in the sand where we say, when you exhibit this, then you officially have insert mental health disorder. And she's like, the problem with the mental health world, and you can correct me if I'm not articulating this quite well, but the problem with the mental health world is that it is a bit more nebulous than saying you have cancer or you don't have cancer. You know, everybody kind of experiences their emotional, their interior world in a different way. And what even is functioning is sometimes, what does it mean to be functional is sometimes a hard question to answer. But she said the exact same thing that you just did, where she was like, you know, if we come to a point, Amanda, where this anxiety is preventing you from being able to live the life that is that you reasonably want to live and to show up for your responsibilities and show up for the people around you and show up for yourself, then we kind of start moving into, you know, not just kind of cognitive behavioral stuff, but maybe looking at kind of the more medical intervention side of things. Support. And that was, it was so helpful and so frustrating. Because I think we so often just long for a label, as much as it's like nobody wants to be labeled as broken. Sometimes we just want, we want a very clear diagnosis that's like, this is what you have, and this is what you should do, and this is how you fix it. And that's not how mental health works, right?
That's not how it works. You know, one of the things that I use in my clinical work to help, help understand that line, that threshold, is a person's baseline.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I will do with someone is sort of go back in their history and really chart the course in a chronological fashion of when they were at their maximal functioning level. Yeah. Now, again, this is subjective, right? So where they felt like they were at their peak, and then we'll sort of continue and then talk about, okay, when did this loss occur? And since that point, as we sort of compare today to the past, where do we think we are? Yeah. And again, there's no black and white definitive markers, but that can provide a space for the person to at least reflect on what's typical for them. Because you're right. If a person is already clinically depressed or experiencing that before a loss, is it abnormal for them to continue to have those symptoms? Yeah. Well, probably not. If a person is extremely high functioning and has not experienced any functional impairment, now they're unable to get out of bed, that's a different conversation. And so I think that we've got to be really careful about assessing baseline.
Yeah.
As another.
Oh, that's so helpful. And I hope anyone who's listening to this, that what they hear more than anything is just permission to kind of explore what it is that you're feeling and what resources are out there for you, and not thinking that like to struggle with grief, to struggle with mental health does not mean that you get kind of labeled forever as being broken. We all struggle. This is life. This is what it means to be human, and there are incredible resources available to us if we need them, and to give yourself permission to access them, you know?
When clients first meet with me, Amanda, one of the things that they probably are frustrated about that I say is, as we sort of walk this path together, let's both expect moments of sadness. Mm. Let's expect that anger might show up. Let's expect that fatigue and social disconnection might show up. And it's my way of saying, let's give yourself permission, right? So that when it comes, the person's not stigmatizing themselves or marginalizing themselves, thinking, what's wrong with me? Nothing's wrong with you. We anticipated that.
Right.
So I sort of give them a menu to sort of anticipate. Mm-hmm. Now, it may not show up for the same, for different people in the same way. Yeah. However, if it does, that's okay. Yeah. We expected that.
Oh, that's good.
And I think that helps some in some ways lessen the blow when those things arise along the journey.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, before we say goodbye, I want to kind of give you an opportunity to speak a little bit. You know, we mentioned kind of the spiritual impact of grief and what that can look like. On the one hand, I feel like Christians love to talk about grief because they feel like they have a lot of answers for grief. And on the other hand, I feel like Christians like to avoid grief because they really love stories of triumph and victory and joy in the Lord.
Yep.
But I would love to hear what you think. And I ask some of my other guests this too, what you think the difference is between spiritual bypassing, or what a lot of people are calling toxic positivity, but also reminding mm-hmm. people of the hope that they have. What's the difference there?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that spiritual bypassing, as I sort of conceptualize it, is when we're interacting with someone mm-hmm. grieving, or as we sort of look at ourselves, are we allowing the full spectrum of emotion, right? So if you hit your leg on a table, there's no way that you would say, get over it, that's nothing, yeah. right? You would acknowledge, wow, gosh, my leg is throbbing, yeah. and I'm going to be okay yeah. after I sort of tend to yeah. this. Sometimes in spiritual circles, we'll experience the significant pain or observe it, and we'll say, that doesn't really exist. God is good. Yeah. Everything happens for mm-hmm. a reason, right? You know, there's a day for more, a time for mourning, and a day for a time for yeah. joy. And we will completely eliminate or minimize the reality that pain exists. Yeah. So I think in those scenarios, that's an example of spiritual bypass.
Yeah. yeah.
Like we are literally circumventing the reality.
Right. right.
At the same time, I think that there's room for mm-hmm. hope. And so it really is, and you know this better than most with holy unhappiness, mm-hmm. it's both yeah. and. It's both yeah. and, right? I can grieve and I can observe someone grieving and acknowledge the fact that they are hopeful. Mm-hmm. So it prevents me from saying things like, well, if you're questioning, you know, spiritually where you are, it doesn't mean that you lack faith. Yeah. It means that we expected these questions to arise because all of this is spiritually overwhelming,
yeah, yeah.
right? So I think we've got to be careful. We've got to provide room for there to be an acceptance of what yeah. is, and that's pain, yeah. heartache, yeah. irritability, anger, questioning, yeah. doubt, and know that God is with you in the midst yeah. of that, and he can handle all
yeah.
of those things,
yeah.
right? And nowhere in the Bible are things happening and God is saying, well, that's not really real,
yeah.
right? It's real. And I see that. And I'm here yeah, for you.
Right. Right.
Right. So, it's
yeah. Cool. You know, when I studied resilience and things like that when I was working in staff care for aid workers. And one of the kind of key factors for resilience is meaning in adversity. And I want to be careful and say, I don't think this means we always have to find the silver lining or that we even can always find That's the right. silver lining or that this redemptive story yeah. arc presents itself to us immediately mm-hmm. when we begin to suffer. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned something about how God worked in the loss of your mother, her death, your grieving mm-hmm. of her. Tell me about your meaning in adversity.
Yeah, so I will acknowledge that that did not come right away, and I was resisting. So I sort of felt God pulling me to this space of sharing my story, yeah. which I didn't want to do, partly because it was revealing intimate thoughts that yeah. I had. You know, if you've read my book or someone gets my book, it really is a reflection on actual journal entries that I had mm-hmm. from the time my mom was yeah. diagnosed to years after she yeah. died. And so it was very intimate to me, and I didn't want to reveal that. Yet I felt God calling me to do that because I didn't see those things. Like I didn't find those sorts of books, and I yeah. wanted to know, what are people actually thinking? Yeah. Am I the only one who's questioning God, that God is yeah. good? Am I the only one whose body is shutting down in the midst of this loss? Yeah. And am I the only one who is finding myself fine one day and completely falling apart the next? Yeah. And so that's what sort of led me to do that. But it wasn't until I finished the book mm-hmm. that I was really able to reflect back and say, wow, the purpose of my mom's death wasn't to teach mm-hmm, a lesson. Mm-hmm. And even if she hadn't died, God could have used other things in my yeah. life to help me see yeah. him. However, in her death, here are some things that I discovered. Yeah. Here are some experiences that helped me see God differently mm-hmm. and experience him in a different way than before she had
yeah.
died,
yeah.
right? So again, I think we've got to always keep in mind that there is no purpose, yes. right? God is not using this to teach. Yeah. However, in the midst of it, there may be discoveries that we yeah. make about ourselves, humanity, and God himself.
I am so glad you said that because I feel like that's the thing whenever I say it, I kind of tense up, like, is it okay for me to say this? That, like, I don't mm-hmm. really believe anymore that God takes things away from you to teach you a lesson. Like, God right. can teach any way that he wants. I believe that good and beautiful things happen in the aftermath of grief, happen in the aftermath yes. of mental health struggles that might not have happened mm-hmm. had you not gone through them. And our God is a redeemer, and our God redeems yeah. things. But it yeah. is kind of like this whole purpose in your pain thing is a real heavy, heavy talking point, I feel like, among yeah. Christians of my generation.
I really struggle when I sort of read things like from this to yeah. that, because it again, I think it subtly sends that message yeah. that we've got to have a redemption story yeah. and it started off bad yeah. and it ended up good. Yeah. But the reality is that it may always feel
yeah.
bad.
Yeah.
And there may be hope yeah. in that. So again, back to your book, I think that it just completely captures that, like, holy unhappiness, mm-hmm. right? That there is holiness even in the things that we don't consider joyful,
right?
Or in the things that we might consider tedious and ordinary. And so I think along the grief journey, what we've got to do, and this is different for mm-hmm. everyone, is to keep our hearts open as much as possible mm-hmm. to curiosity yeah. for the moments that God may allow us to see, oh gosh, here's what I discovered about mm-hmm. myself, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. But we're not putting pressure on yeah. ourselves to find yeah, it.
Right. It's just it's another really twisted form of self-improvement. It's like, I'm going to use this grief experience to improve myself. It's like,
that's right.
Let's not do that either. Exactly and right. also, like, we are constantly being molded and shaped into Christ-likeness. And part of Christ-likeness, turns out, is actually sorrow and grief, because he was a man of sorrows. Like, it's a God of sorrows.
But yes.
You're very kind about yes. my book. Speaking of books, tell our listeners where they can get your book. Tell them where they can find you online and find your work.
Yeah. So my book, again, is Relaxing Into the Pain, My Journey into Grief and Beyond. So you can find it through Amazon if you just Google that. Also West Bow Press, WESTBROW. Press. And then in terms of finding me, I hang out a lot on Instagram. You'll discover a lot of grief education yeah. there, some inspiration. And really my goal is to empower people to know that you can live in the both
yes.
and, yeah. right? You can grieve and experience hope. You can grieve and live. And amid loss, there are moments that you can also discover yeah. aspects of who you are. So my handle on Instagram is at Dr. Mikkel.
Well, I hope people follow you there, because I mean, like, there's a lot of just mediocre content on the internet. And I feel like there have been so many times where you've done just a really short, concise post that totally explained something I was experiencing, and I've carried it with me. It's been a great tool. So I hope people find you. And I'm just so thrilled to talk with you again. It's wonderful to connect. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Yes. No, thank you for sharing space. I felt like I was just sitting in your living room.
Isn't it great?
I appreciate your comfort and your sincerity.
Thank you, Dr. Mikkel.